let me in. Shibop, shibop. I want to be closer to you. Shibop, shibop. Open up your soul. Shibop, shibop. Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where I try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or in this case, understand something. Yes, my friends, it's the first Monday of the month, and as you know, I like to have science envoys from Wonderfest on to talk about their branch of science and what they do. Here is my science envoy du jour. Welcome, Enrico Calvanese. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on the show today. So before we get into your science, let's get into you, which is, when did you first discover that you were really into science?
Right, so I was thinking about that question, and it's hard for me to pinpoint exactly when I started getting curious about how things happen and how to explain the world around us. But I'm a plant biologist. I'm studying plant biology at UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you when I got interested in plant biology or just the understanding of plants. I remember this very clearly. I was watching a documentary as I did as a child. This must mm-hmm. have been when I was either in middle school or elementary school. I'm not quite sure. Mm-hmm. But I really loved watching documentaries. Mm-hmm. And generally, they were all about animals, you know, National Geographic or Discovery Channel. But this one was talking about plants. And I had never really thought about plants much until that point. But they were discussing how giant bamboos, which are originally to some parts of Asia, mm-hmm. can grow up to 1 meter in one day if the right conditions are present. And that fascinated me way more than anything that I had watched before.
Yeah.
And from that point on, I realized I think I need to understand how something like that can happen, how organisms that seems to be so, well, maybe not simple, but maybe passive, maybe they're in the background. You don't really think about plants all that much, but they mm-hmm. can do such amazing things. That was the moment when I really decided, okay, I'm going to pay attention to the organisms and I'm going to try to understand them better.
That's very cool. If I had watched that documentary, I would be begging my parents to get me a baby bamboo to see if I could watch it grow over the course. You know, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot. So
yeah, it's impressive.
Yeah, it really is. So you hear this and it hits your imagination the way nothing can. So going forward, are you reading more about plants or does that something that happens later on?
Yeah, so from that moment on, of course, nothing happened immediately mm-hmm. after watching the documentary, but I started being, of all the classes that I was taking, elementary school student, and then later high schooler, I started to really get more interested in biology. Mm-hmm. And I had the fortune to be selected for a science, like young researcher program, where I was given the option in, well, the country where I was raised, which is the country of Panama, mm-hmm. to participate in research, just to shadow someone that was doing research and then present my findings at a young scientist's fair. Something that's, you know, not incredibly impactful, but for me it was really impactful. And the reason I was able to get selected was because I proposed to study how bamboos can grow so fast and in such a short period of time. So that documentary led me to get interested in science, talk about science, even mm-hmm. At the time it was definitely a more childish and superficial way, but at least show enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And then that channeled me through fortune and the good stewardship of my mother into the right programs that eventually actually got me to participate in real science.
So when you got that grant to talk about it, about how old were you?
So by that time, it was, I'm trying to remember the year more or less. Well, I was in what would be the equivalent of a freshman year of high school.
Oh, okay. So you're still pretty young.
Yes, because that was a program that functioned in that way. It was intended to get young people, and that's, you know, really young people, so high schoolers, elementary kids, middle schoolers, to be interested in science and to, in one way, participate with real scientists and at a young adult's fair present their science.
So when you were shadowing this scientist, was that scientist also someone who studied plants, or what kind of science did they do, and what kind of questions did you have for them, and was it exciting to trail this person around and ask questions?
No, I think that's a good question, because although I proposed a scientific question, a scientific project that related to studying bamboos, and at the time I was proposing something really grandiose. If we understand how bamboos grow so fast, maybe we can make other plants grow so fast, maybe trees that give us fruits can go so fast, and I was proposing something that was very ambitious, and of course it's what a high schooler would do. But that only showed my enthusiasm to a sort of screening team that eventually picked me to shadow someone that was doing graduate level research in something completely different. I was ended up studying through that program how malaria parasites, which are actually endemic to the Republic of Panama and cause a lot of devastation, unfortunately, how malaria parasites infect the blood, communicate with each other, considering there are multiple of them in the bloodstream, how they communicate with each other, how they send signals, and how those signals eventually can lead to really negative outcomes in patients. So it's an interesting story because my interest in one area of biology, plant biology, at that moment allowed me to participate in a program that then channeled me to a different area of biology. And then from there, I did research. I did the kind of research that, yes, it had to do with malaria parasites, very different from plant biology.
Sure.
But was still related to biology. Still taught me the basic principles of how a lab that studies living things operates and how to pose questions. And it's the posing the questions that is the most important lesson from these kind of experiences. It's not so much the direct experiments and the results that you get from them. At such an early level, that what's really important is how to ask questions and how to think about answering those questions.
So when you were shadowing this person, were they the ones that helped you understand how to ask the questions? And if so, how did they do that?
Well, yeah. So at the time, they... because I was only a high schooler shadowing graduate students, and those graduate students had projects on which their entire graduation and career depended. And of course, it didn't give me the kind of freedom to just run around and do experiments in the lab. They had me shadow all of their daily activities. They didn't really let me touch the expensive equipment, but I was there to see how they did it. And then they let me do everything else that was both low risk in terms of, you know, personal safety risk, as well as not so complex that I wouldn't be able to perform it.
Okay.
But they taught me, well, if this is up to where the field in this particular area is, the area of malaria research, here is up where we are. Here are the things that really matter for our field to understand if we want to eventually come up with a cure for malaria. Before we get to that point, we need to understand how this parasite infects the blood cells, how it does critical steps in its biology. And here is how we think we can answer a very specific question in a very specific time frame, which is the time frame of that graduate student's graduate career.
Wow, that's incredible. So they light a fire under you in a different section of biology. So then
right.
you go on to university, and do you pursue biology generally? Do you pursue a specific sub genre of biology? What happens once you hit university?
Right. So that was sort of a stepping stone for me to eventually be convinced that this is really what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Early high schooler, I realized, okay, I want to become a scientist. But I want to still go back to my original interest in plant biology.
Okay.
And once I had determined that that should be the path forward, then I started to reflect on how I could get there. And there is no real other way than to do an undergraduate degree in a biology-related field,
mm-hmm.
and then do a PhD, which is where I am right now, in that area. So I started from that sort of premise that I need to do these steps to become a researcher. And then I went and looked at where those could be completed, where I could do those degrees, and I looked at the United States because it was the most accessible education system nearby the Republic of Panama that mm-hmm. I could get into.
Okay.
So I looked at a number of universities. I was fortunate enough, again, through the good stewardship of my mother, to end up in an early entrance to college program, which is virtually a program that allows seniors and juniors in high school to go to an American university to finish their high school there and get dual credit.
Wow.
So I did that, and that was in Missouri, at Northwest Missouri State University.
Uh-huh.
When I graduated from high school, I had an Associate of Science degree because I had taken those college credits.
Uh-huh.
And then I was able to use that. I already had sort of my foot in the door of the American education system, so I understood a lot better how to apply to finally undergraduate university, and so I did so, and I was able to get into Franklin and Marshall College in Pennsylvania, where I did majored in biochemistry and molecular biology.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I realized the most important thing that I needed to do while I was an undergraduate was to build up my resume in terms of research experience. As well mm-hmm. as having decent grades, the most important thing was really get into the lab of someone at that undergraduate university to demonstrate later on what I would apply to a PhD program that I had the skills, the experience, and most importantly, the interest and persistence to pursue research. And so from the first year of my undergraduate career at that university, I contacted the only professor in that university, quite a small college, I was the only professor that did plant biology research,
uh-huh.
and asked him to join my lab, if I could join his lab, and he was very generous, allowed me to join from the start, and then I stayed there for 3 years doing research, and actually he was a plant biologist, yeah, so I was able to do research in plant biology, and that gave me the skill set and the curriculum to be able to apply to UC Berkeley's plant biology program. In 2020, I started my PhD, and now I'm at the end of my fourth year, so beginning my fifth year.
Okay. It sounds like you were very, very focused and disciplined about getting from point A to point B in terms of your academic career, and it sounds like your mom was thoroughly on board with it.
Yes, she never. Well, I want to be clear that she never forced me into any particular direction.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to make sure that I really was dedicated to, and that I really had a genuine interest in science. And once she saw that, she was all hands on deck to help me get to where I got. So eventually, where I got. there's also a bit of a technical aspect to being so, I guess, focused on getting, as you said, from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
As for international students, it's a little harder to take things like gap years and to maybe be more flexible in one's career path than it is for domestic students.
Sure.
It has to do with complicated things such as visas and, well, I don't want to get into that. But there was both the, yeah, the tenacity on the and the support from my mother, as well as the way things work if you're an international student in the United States.
Yeah, I have relatives from Panama, and I've seen firsthand what, you know, the whole visa thing. So I feel your pain. So, but I'm very impressed by your, you know, your focus and your drive. And I'm sure that that carried through whenever anybody interviewed you for things. I do have a question. Is there a difference between being a plant biologist and being a botanist?
Yeah. So sometimes the terms are used interchangeably. And for the most, there's no harm done in using them interchangeably.
Uh-huh.
And the field, the ways you could study plants are so wide that at the end, the lines really get blurred. Well, I tell people I'm a plant cell biologist because what I really study is the individual workings of a cell in a very specific kind of plant.
Oh, okay.
Botanists, and perhaps botanists may even have a different definition of how they see themselves, botanists are perhaps more focused on development, on taxonomy, on maybe ecosystem level understanding of studies of plant biology. You would imagine, for example, somebody that works for the National Forest Service or National Park Service and that is in charge of classifying, cataloging the species in the park that they work at or in the United States, and studying their health, the overall health of those forests or of those trees. It's a more, I suppose, it's a different scale of study. Whereas a plant biologist can, of course, study that when necessary, but a plant biologist may be studying different things at a different scale, much closer to the molecular level. At the end, anything that we study just generally tends to go back to the molecular level, the cell biology level.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you study a particular plant. Is it bamboo?
Yeah. So I study, so before I tell you the name of the plant that I study, it's useful to give some context.
Okay.
So you know how when researchers that want to cure human diseases like cancer, dementia, all sorts of diseases, they go and they study not a human necessarily, but lab rats, lab mice, or other organisms, other animals like worms, like fruit flies. That's because, obviously, you cannot experiment in humans, but it's also technically more challenging to experiment in a human being, if besides the ethical considerations. So those are called model organisms. A mouse is a model organism. It serves as a mammal that is close enough to humans that you can understand human biology through the lenses of mice biology.
Okay.
It's not, of course, a perfect comparison, and later more studies are performed, like in primates, to get closer, and eventually clinical trials. So there's that whole progression. If you are studying human diseases and you want to propose a cure to a disease, you have to start with a model organism and then move up the ladder, and at each scale show that your treatment is effective or that your principle is valid.
Okay.
And in plant biology, there's a similar pattern. So what we would like to do is understand how crops work, because that is what has the largest impact to human society.
Mm-hmm.
How do we grow better wheat? How do we grow better corn? How do we grow better fruit trees?
Mm-hmm.
But those organisms take a long time to grow, And some of them can be very big indeed, like fruit trees. If you wanted to understand how apples work, you cannot study them in a small lab because it's an apple tree. It's huge. So you need to go back to a model organism, a species that is small, easy to handle, but it's still a plant. It can give you very good insights into how plants work.
Okay.
And after that long answer, I get to the plant that I study, which is called Arabidopsis thaliana, also called mouse earcrest. And it's a family that includes the mustards, but this plant specifically doesn't have, you wouldn't have found it on your backyard or anywhere. It's native to Europe. It's a very small plant, and it's very versatile for the study of plant biology because it has a small genome. So everything, its entire DNA has been sequenced. It can produce a lot of seeds, which is good if you want to study, if you want to have a lot of plant material, and if you want to do all sorts of studies that require you to have a lot of progeny. You can easily manipulate it genetically to ask questions about how specific parts of the genome work. And therefore, it's a very versatile and very good model organism.
Wow. So you have, so what's it called again, the street name for it?
Let's just call it Arabidopsis.
Arabidopsis. So you have this Arabidopsis. You're looking at it under the microscope. And what is it that you are seeing when you are, and what is it that you're looking for when you're looking at it in the microscope?
Yes, and now we get under really into the weeds of the work. So I'm going to try to be as understanding that this is. I'm going to try to avoid jargon. But so what I am particularly asking, and you know, this plant is studied by hundreds of thousands of people, and each of those researchers is asking a different question. I am one of them. I'm asking specifically how a protein of interest, okay, actually, let's start from first principle. We have observed that one of the many genes in the Arabidopsis genome, when it's knocked out, which means when it is affected in a way that prevents it from being functional, so we get rid of this gene by all means and by all intents and purposes. We get rid of this gene. We observe that a plant that would normally grow very well, be very healthy, grows into a very poor, very dwarfed, sterile plant. So it has a lot of problems developing.
Okay.
So we see there's a big developmental effect of knocking out this gene. This gene must be really important for something in this plant at the cellular level that allows the plant to grow normally. Because when we lack it, when we lack this gene, the plant doesn't grow well.
Okay.
And so then we started studying what this gene does, and we realized, we noticed, okay, this is a protein. It's so this gene has the information to encode for a protein that's normal, so that is the general way that biology works. You have a gene that eventually gets turned into a protein, and the protein is the actual part that performs a function. The gene is just the information. And this protein is moving other proteins around. So it's kind of like a little messenger inside the cell, taking things from one point to another. And what I looked under the microscope, to get to your question, is how was the cell of a plant that doesn't have, of an Arabidopsis plant that doesn't have this gene, how is this cell moving things around, the things that would require that gene? And what we noticed is that, well, it really cannot do that function at all. You'd really need to have this gene in order to move critical material around the cell. And without it, those materials don't move. And what we're trying to show is that this is really important for the development of the plant to justify our initial observation that this gene is important for development.
So when you're looking underneath, and like, are you seeing actual physical movement, or are you seeing chemical reactions? What is it that is going on in that cell that you can see?
Right. So, yes, we're looking at the physical movement of these cargo proteins. So we call them cargo proteins. They are the ones that our gene is responsible for moving. So they are the things that normally would be moving, but in our plant, they're not moving the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we observe them is actually probably going to be very interesting, I think, for people to hear. We use a fluorescent tag to see their movement under the microscope. What does that mean? This is not just something that is just done in plants. Actually, 20 or 25 or so years ago, it was discovered that it's possible to take a gene from a jellyfish. So bear with me.
Uh-huh.
Take a gene from a jellyfish, which, as you may know, are autoluminescence in water. When you move the water, you're kayaking, you may see autoluminescence. There is a green autoluminescence. So there, you can take a gene that makes this green fluorescence, and you can engineer it so that it's fused to the proteins that you want to observe. Normally, you wouldn't be able to observe proteins because they don't have any color.
Okay.
But if you put this sort of flag by engineering this jellyfish gene as a flag on the protein that you want to see, and then you put that into, you transform that into the genome of your plant, then you will be able to observe whichever protein it is that you're interested in observing. Then you can see it under the microscope. If you shine lasers at it, it will luminesce in a bright green color, and you'll be able to actually observe inside a cell that protein moving. It's a way of turning the invisible into the visible by putting a flag on it.
Wow. And is that is taking that bioluminescent material from jellyfish something that is used widely?
Yes. This is a widely used technique for decades now to understand how things, well, proteins, move around cells. So one of the first questions that somebody will be interested in asking as a researcher is, if I am studying protein A or protein B, where does it go in the cell? Because that's deeply going to be related to the function of that protein.
Uh-huh.
And so the best way to address that, the cheapest, most practical way to address that, is by fusing this green fluorescent protein, GFP, onto your protein of interest. Once you have that fusion of your protein A with GFP, then you can look at the localization of protein A. And it's widely effective, widely used across organisms. And you may have seen at some point, maybe if these are the things that interest you, images of fluorescent mice and fluorescent fruit flies,
uh-huh.
because they have this genetic modification. And it's because, well, somebody was interested in studying where a mouse protein or a fruit fly protein was localizing.
And does adding this affect it in any other way besides its luminescence, or is it something that is pretty neutral?
So this is something that scientists evaluate on an individual case by case, So yeah, that is a very valid question. If you're adding this tag, this fluorescent tag, is it affecting the way the protein, the original protein, works? And the answer can be yes or no. And so to know if you're really observing the true localization and true function of your protein, you have to do what is called a complementation experiment, where you take, so let's imagine that you're studying mutant protein A. You want to know protein's A localization.
Mm-hmm.
You take a mouse that has been edited, so it doesn't have protein A. So this mouse is lacking protein A. And you transform this mouse, or this Arabidopsis plant, I'm just using a general model organism,
mm-hmm.
and you transform that mouse with the protein A plus GFP. So you want to see that mutant mouse, the mouse that doesn't have the protein, once it's introduced, once it's given the protein fused with GFP, whether it can look like a normal mouse. And if it can, that means that your protein plus the green fluorescence jellyfish GFP actually has a normal function because it can rescue the function of a mutant. I hope the concept makes sense.
It kind of does, yeah. So you're if I'm understanding it, you're saying that you compare the two, and if they behave the same, then you know everything's okay.
Exactly. If it works just the way that the regular protein without the GFP works, then you know that it's a functional protein, and that the GFP tagging, that adding the fluorescence protein, doesn't affect the protein in any meaningful way.
And then, what do you do with the knowledge that is gained from observing these cells, these microscopic cells?
Right. So that generally the information that you get from these microscopic, this is called microscopic evidence, it gives you insights into where the protein is functional, mm-hmm. as well as if there are any difference between a mutant or a what would be called a wild type, so a normal organism. In my case, I observe that my proteins of interest are not localized correctly in the mutant background, the mutant that I am studying. And so this is very direct evidence that the protein that I study, the mutant that I study, is needed mm-hmm. for localizing those proteins in the right position. Once I have that evidence, I will go on to do a lot of other studies that are targeted directly at those proteins that I have demonstrated have a defect. And so I don't want to perhaps make it too complicated, but this will depend on a case by case. So in my case, I can see, okay, my gene of interest mm-hmm. affects the localization of this set of proteins. This set of proteins has a function. This function could be a function in working at this part of the cell, or making this part of the cell, or building the plant in this way, making a leaf, making a root, making a part of or a chemical compound. Okay, so I've discovered it has this function. Now I need to test whether each of these genes is affecting this process directly. I have this hint that there is a function that's being affected, and I need to then design specific experiments for that specific function that I have detected.
Wow. And so after you've designed all this, what is your ultimate goal?
So at this level, and actually this may bring a discussion of sort of the areas of research. There's the kind of research that is called basic research or fundamental research, mm-hmm. and then there is the research called applied mm-hmm. research. So applied sciences versus fundamental sciences. I am doing a fundamental science project, which means I am studying something for the purpose of simply understanding better the functioning of the cell, the okay. plant cell. It could be any other, you know, mouse cell, whatever, but I'm studying plants. So I am doing this project simply to understand at a deeper level the way that a plant cell works. Fundamental research eventually then is taken up by other researchers who do applied sciences, and the applied sciences focus on taking that knowledge, that fundamental knowledge, and devising applications that are of some human value. And so turning that deep understanding of plant biology, plant cell biology, and making a crop that is more resistant to drought, mm-hmm. or making it more resistant to heat, making it more productive, or telling breeders that are just breeding plants which genes to be breeding for, which particular combinations and crosses to make. So those are the two broad divisions of research. And as a fundamental scientist, once I complete and I have enough evidence to show a new way in which the cell behaves and does things and does the fundamental things, I will then write what is called a scientific paper, a scientific mm-hmm. article. Mm-hmm. And I will present a lot of that data into figures, and I will write all the sections of a paper, a discussion, a results section, and I will present that to the scientific community so that there is a new and better understanding of a fundamental aspect of the cell. And the hope is that that feeds into what either applied scientist in academia or in government or in industry uses to design plants that can be more beneficial in some aspect to agriculture.
That's amazing. That just sounds like you as the fundamental researcher, you're providing the groundwork or the foundation for someone to be able to do something really practical with it that can be very beneficial. So I love that entire explanation. So, yes.
If I can, just give some examples, the majority, actually, the entirety of the innovations in biotechnology that have surfaced over the decades are all the product of fundamental scientists discovering, refining our knowledge of living organisms. I am going to bring it up because it's probably what's most closest to people's memory. The discovery of mRNA's vaccine wasn't performed entirely, actually, in the majority of it, wasn't the product of the companies that eventually brought the vaccine to market. Mm-hmm. It's the product of decades and decades and decades of research in universities in the United States and across the world. Research that was published and then was available to the scientists, to the applied scientists at the companies that made those vaccines, that could then turn, make that final step and devise how to actually use that to produce, well, the vaccine or any other biotechnological product.
Amazing. Enrico, I could talk to you for hours about this because this just sounds fascinating, but we're almost out of time. So I want to make sure our listening audience has some information. Like, if they wanted to find out more about your research, how would they go about doing that?
You can find my profile on, if you search my name, Enrico Calvanese, plus UC Berkeley, you will see my photo pop up. I'm at the plant biology department, and you will be able to navigate to my laboratory's webpage where you'll get more information on what our laboratory does. If you then would like to specifically ask more questions, I'll be available to answer them. You can find my email there, or you can also connect with me through LinkedIn or any other platform.
And then if there's some young mind out there who is interested in plant biology, is there any book or documentary that you would recommend that they check out?
So if they want to be wowed by biology in general, and not just plant biology, but also plant biology, mm-hmm. I would recommend the same thing that I did that got me excited about it, which is watch the archives of documentaries that are already freely available everywhere online. I watched them when when YouTube at least wasn't full of these videos. Sure. I watched them on National Geographic, Discovery Channel, all the sorts. And I would say now they're even more available. So you can do that. And if you are a local to the Bay Area, then there is a class that actually is available to high schoolers called Genomes and Plant Health. It's not something that I am running, but it's something that I participate as an instructor, and it's available to high schoolers. So you should look up Genomes and Plant Health. It is run by one of the laboratories at the Plant Biology Department, and they will provide a free 2-day workshops on teachings of plant genetics and genomics.
Excellent, excellent. Well, and Enrico Calvanese, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. I found it fascinating. And once again, I look forward to hearing more about your research.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. And just stay on the line. I have a couple of questions for you for afterwards. People of Earth, that was plant biology. There's so many ways in which you can learn stuff. He did an amazing job of explaining what he does. And we're going to be talking in a little bit with the San Francisco Mime Troupe, and they're going to do an amazing job about talking about their show. So stay tuned. Is Arthur Adams and Blues Roots. Get it? Roots, plants from Stomp the Floor. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. And guess what? It's that season again. The San Francisco Mime Troupe is getting gearing up and about to do something fabulous. You know, they always have something ready for 4th of July. This year is no exception. Here to talk about it, I'd like to welcome Valina Brown, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, and how are you?
Good, good.
Now, Valina, how long have you been with the San Francisco Mime Troupe?
Well, I first worked with them as a replacement actor in 1992.
Wow! What were you, like three at the time or something? My goodness.
Yep. Long time. And then, and so then the first time I got to originate a role, you know, was in 94.
Okay.
And so I've been working with them.
Well, let me ask you this. When you, when they said you could, that they needed a replacement actor, was it like, this is my big break. I'm going to be a star.
Well, I felt like this is my chance to work with this company that I really admire. You know, like I, cause my, my husband, boyfriend at the time, but now husband, Michael Gene Sullivan, he first started working with them in 88. And okay. So I got to see some of their shows and just really appreciated what they were doing and went like, oh man, it would be amazing to get to do one of their shows, you know, at least once. And so like over 30 years later, I've done a bunch of them, but, yeah, I just, I was really excited to have a chance to, you know, be a part of, of what the troupe does. It's very unique.
And so, so here we are, you know, decades later, you're still going strong. How, like, how often do you get like new blood coming into the program?
Well, we have new blood coming in, you know, pretty regularly. We have a new person, Nikki Johnson, who has never worked with us before, but she's very talented and really funny, and she's going to be playing Michael's granddaughter in this show. And yeah, so we have like people who that we have. It's a small cast. This, you know, this is our four person show this year. So we have Michael, Gene Sullivan, Andre Amorodico, Lizzie Calogero, and this new lovely person, Mickey Johnson.
Wow.
Yeah. And yeah. And then we also like have different, sometimes it's, it can be like new, we have a new musician this year as well, who's a bass player. Okay, now I'm not thinking of her last name. Isn't that awful? I should have everybody's name right in front of me. But Caroline it might be, I don't want to say the wrong thing, but it's like the bass player that we didn't get a
Chung?
Chance to work
Is it
with
Caroline
before.
Chung? Because I'm looking at your website.
I have to double check that because I don't want to say the wrong
thing. Well, I'm looking at your website, so it says Caroline Chung
is
bass, so, and Daniel Savio on keyboards. And Dred Scott.
So Dred, we worked with Dred years ago, and then he moved to New York and has been out there for a long time. But we had an opportunity to work with him again, and then he knew Caroline. And so we had someone that we worked with back, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then he brought in someone who's brand new to us, who's fantastic.
Very nice. So what's the show this year?
This year, American Dreams is the title.
Mm-hmm.
And the plural dreams really is sort of a comment on the fact that, I mean, you know, we grew up hearing about the American dream.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems like there's such a fracture, you know, like such a fracture. Not that the United States has been like this, completely cohesive, country always. There's always been some fissures and sides and whatnot, but it's just like completely splintered feeling right now.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point where it's not even clear what that identity, what the aspiration is anymore. Like there was that, people are not being treated equally all the time, whatever, but there's that aspiration,
mm-hmm.
right? That most people were trying to live up to it. It seemed, that's my point of view. Some might disagree. I think most people were trying to live up to the dream or whatever. And now it's like some people don't have a problem with democracy being on the chopping block. That was part of the American identity, is that we're a democracy. And some people are totally fine with that being on the chopping block. And so one person's dream is another person's nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
It's very splintered right now. So that's sort of what we're talking about.
So did Michael write the script? Did you write the script?
Yes, he did.
Amazing, amazing. So when you are looking at staging something like this, what are some of the challenges?
Well, I think one of the things that we were wanting to do, right, is show all these different people's dreams and nightmares and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, how are we going to depict that, you know? I think that was one of the challenges. But I mm-hmm. feel like we've figured it out. So the different characters have their different dreams that they're having / nightmares as we start off like the day, election day,
mm-hmm.
and the results have come in,
mm-hmm.
right? And then like, then a character ends up falling asleep and it turns out that election day result,
mm-hmm.
that actually was a dream, you know?
Mm.
And so now they're waking up and it's like, oh, there's another week before the election, or then they wake up and there's another month before the election. But what they saw in the dreams in terms of like the ramifications of choices that they made,
mm-hmm.
they got to see how they played out.
Mm-hmm.
So then they realize they have a chance to do something different than the outcome that they saw in their dream/nightmare. So like, okay, how do people know where they are in space and time? Like, that's kind of a challenge, but I think we've figured it out. And I want to encourage people to come and check it out and think about, for themselves a little bit, like, how how do I see what I'm doing right now impacting the outcome? Because I think also that, I think that's the other thing, is that we're talking about how a lot of times people feel like, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, I feel like my vote doesn't matter, or what I do, it doesn't really, I'm just one little person, and so it doesn't matter. And it's like, it's just not true. It really does matter.
It does.
What each one of us does.
If it didn't matter, they wouldn't try so hard to make you not vote.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there are other people who are just like, you know what, just burn it all to the ground and, you know, start over again. And it's like, well, I don't know if you really want to burn it all to the ground, because, you know, maybe you get...
Yeah, I think there are things that people think sounds cool or sounds cute to say, but they wouldn't actually want to not have anything. Like, yeah, the minute you're hungry and you're ready to get some food, and every store's burnt down, and you know, are you a farmer? Like, are we, you know, and even if you were, it takes time to grow food. I mean, you know, I mean, people are not thinking; they just think it sounds cool. Yeah, man, booty, you know, and that's you know,
well, it's like the,
that's not what people generally actually want.
Right, right. It's like when people, when those companies say, oh, we disrupt everything. Well, the pandemic was disruptive. How did that go over, you know? But that's just me. Let's talk about why you're doing it with a small cast this year, a cast of four.
Yeah, which we've done several shows with four casts. And honestly, it has to do with funding. You know, like when we have more funding that's come in, and we can have more actors on the stage, because that's really our preference, I think, is to have like at least six people. But we've done many shows with four, and this is a great cast, and so, you know, we can tell a story with a few people. I mean, and there are one person shows out there. We haven't done a one person show, but you know, that can be really great. So, so yeah, it's good. It's really good. But at the same time, yes, in full transparency, we would like to, be able to work with more artists, you know.
Now, there are people every year who are just discovering the mime troupe for the first time. So for those people who don't necessarily know, where can they see you, when, and how does it all work?
Okay. Yes. Yeah, so I think the first thing we have to say is that the mime troupe does not do silent mime. So if someone is really not familiar with us and they're thinking, oh, we're going to come and see people trapped in a glass box or, you know, struggling against the wind or whatever.
Walking downstairs.
In a striped shirt. That's not us.
Okay.
And we're not putting that down. That just doesn't happen to be what we're doing. We do the definition, kind of the broad definition of mime, which is the exaggeration of everyday life in story and song. So we use words, we speak a lot. We do musical political theater. So if you've ever seen a play or a musical, or, you know, like we do musicals, you know, but they're just, Michael puts it like, we do musicals, but with a point. So we have, you know, a point of view that we're sharing, which is basically talking about what's going on. Either sometimes our stories are local, sometimes they're national, regional, or national, or international. It just depends. Like this year, it's an election year in the United States. And so that's what we're talking about. And we tour parks all over the Bay Area. We open July 4th weekend. And we're July 4th, in, which is a Thursday this year, in Dolores Park. And then we're going to be in Berkeley, Live Oak Park, that Saturday and Sunday. And we tour, you know, parks in San Francisco, in Berkeley, Palo Alto, Oakland. We're going to be at the Bruins Theater, where California Shakes is in Orinda. This year, we haven't done that before, and that's exciting. Mm. They have a lovely space. And then we're going to be up north in Ukiah and where else? Cotati. And then we're also going to be in Santa Cruz. So we're kind of all over the place in the Bay Area and mm-hmm. then up north. And most of our shows are outdoors in the park, and they're free. You don't have to pay to see us, but we will pass the hat and ask you, if you stay and see the show, to put something in the hat, because it does cost money to do what we do. But we don't want anybody to be turned away or not able to see us mm-hmm. because of lack of funds. So how that works is our suggested donation, we have a suggested donation, but okay. People are able to give whatever they can, and that could be zero to,
whatever,
thousands of dollars. It depends. Yeah. But it's free. So if you haven't heard of us and you're like, let me try this out, there's not a big investment there to come and check it out and bring a picnic and put your sunscreen on, wear a sun hat, and just kind of be, with a fun group of people who, our people are fun to hang out with on a lovely day.
So on the 4th of July, this coming Thursday, what mm-hmm. time does the show start in Dolores Park, and what time should people get there?
Well, the play, we have the Mime Troupe Band, because it's live music mm-hmm. that is being played, and they do a half-hour set at 1:30, mm-hmm. and then the play starts at 2. mm-hmm. If you have a specific preference of where you think you'd like to sit, come at least by 1, I would say.
Okay.
Right? Maybe some people come and they see us setting up, because we drive there and unload our big truck that has all of our sound equipment and our stage and mm-hmm. the backstage and the costumes and everything that we unload out of the truck and set up. So we're in the park at 9 in the morning.
Okay.
And so some people are there by, 9 or 10 and see us setting up, because they know they want to be front and center. That's their spot, and they want to stake it out early. But, I would say definitely come and so that you can hear the band at 1:30, and then the show starts at 2.
Excellent. Well, Valina Brown, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. If people want to find out more about the San Francisco Mime Troupe, how would they go about doing that?
Oh, well, check out sfmt.org, mm-hmm. and you can have our full schedule and learn more about us. And there's also content on there that you can listen to, our Tales of the Resistance series that we did during quarantine when we couldn't do a play mm-hmm. in the park. We did a radio series, and that's on our website as well.
Excellent, excellent. Well, once again, Valina Brown, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. People of Earth, this is your opportunity. San Francisco Mime Trip. You can go to the Dolores Park, just go over that little hill. Suddenly you'll see like a bajillion people. It's free. It's fun. Get out of the house because by the way, COVID is raging. So, take the proper precautions so that you can stay healthy. And in the meantime, it's just about time for me to ride off into the sunset. So I will leave you with Joseph Angel. This is called American Funeral. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.
Freedom, run from this demon. Please don't give them a reason to spill blood.